Hi, this is Scott. I really appreciate our sponsors because they make the show possible. Today's show is sponsored by Telerik. Create compelling app experiences across any screen with the Telerik platform. Telerik's end-to-end platform uniquely combines industry-leading UI tools with cloud services to simplify the entire app development cycle. Telerik offers everything .NET developers need to build quality apps faster. Try it free at telerik.com/platform. That's telerik.com/platform.
From HanselMinutes.com, it's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 503. In this episode, Scott talks with computer vision expert Greg Borenstein about imagining and designing a realistic future.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes, and today we're chatting with Greg Borenstein. He is a futurist consultant on one of my favorite shows, The New Minority Report. He's got an extensive background in computer vision and graphics programming and just all things interactive. And you were at the MIT Media Lab for a while, weren't you?
Yeah, that's right. I just graduated in June from the Playful Systems group there.
I love that there is even a Playful Systems group. Is it just literally making stuff that's fun, or why is it called Playful Systems?
One big aspect of it you could think of as kind of the future of games, like thinking about how to make games in different environments. And then the other aspect of it is really using a playful approach to all the different systems that exist in our world, the same way games do with the systems that they present, taking a similar kind of systemic interaction approach to the real systems in our world that we live in.
Very cool. So you are currently a futurist consultant, or consulting on the future in Minority Report, which is the TV show that is currently out right now with Megan Good, which is kind of an extension of the Minority Report movie with Tom Cruise. How do you get a gig like that?
Well, first of all, I don't try to call myself a futurist, because I think that's often a name for people who are like, take a little bit too much credit for their ability to predict things.
Well,
and
yeah, there's
it has
people
to do with
who
more
put,
about prediction.
People who put thought leader in their Twitter bio.
Yeah, futurist has that same kind of feeling to me. Because so I think of it as like, you know, scientific and research consultant. And a big part of that is it's less about trying to predict the future. You know, and then it is about how do you depict the future in a way that says something interesting about today, and also what technologies or coming social changes or other things like that that are coming are going to, you know, are going to shape how we think of, you know, how we think of society, how we live as people, and then how can we depict and explain those effects to an audience that's never seen them before.
That's interesting. Let's take that apart a little bit. I like the way that you phrased that. So this isn't as much me, like I'm going to go into the future and then come back and then tell Greg whether he was right or not, as much as it's taking where we're kind of headed, the vector that we're headed in, and getting a general sense of like, yeah, I could see this coming to a certain point. And then what would be the social ramifications of that if in fact we went in that direction?
Yeah, absolutely. And part of that is because of the timeline of the show, which is 50 years out. It's set in 2065. If you talk to anyone, you know, as I did for this, to do the work for the show, talk to a ton of scientists and technologists and engineers working in a wide variety of different fields, and you ask them 50 years, they all throw up their hands and say, 50 years is impossible. You know, they can tell you very exactly what will happen in 5 years. They can give you extremely grand long-term ambitions in, you know, 100 years, but like 50 years is totally impossible. It's like off the end of anything currently being imagined, but not far enough to be totally magic. So part of that, the way we take advantage of that is like, you know, some of the things we put in the show, we say they're 50 years, but they're really much, much sooner than that. They're 5 to 10 years, but a naive audience who's never heard of the topic before wouldn't believe it if you told them that's what it was. So a great example of that is in the first episode, bringing the passenger pigeons back from extinction, which is something that, you know, people are actively working on today and will happen in the next 5 to 10 years. And that is, but if you tell people that happened in 2020, 2025, they wouldn't believe you. So by being out 50 years, you get, you know, much more leeway for people believing, surprising things like that.
Interesting. You know, it's so funny that they say hindsight is 20/20. You know, the iPad was not that long ago, you know?
Yeah.
And Star Trek The Next Generation had, you know, these LCARS pads that they called them PADD that were effectively iPads and seemed almost a little bit less sophisticated than what we have now. And they were going 300 years out. If you had told someone by now we'd have these things and we could ask Siri questions, then I think they wouldn't believe it.
Yeah, the iPads in Star Trek are something I'm totally obsessed with because it's an example, I think, of something that people get really wrong about futurism, which is they have the form. Right? People talk about like how Star Trek invented the cell phone or invented the iPad like that. And those iPads, if you watch them on Star Trek, they have the form factor. You know, it's this tablet computer. But the way they use them, when you look at them today, it seems just crazy. Like, people are constantly handing them to each other. Or, like, in one of the movies, they show Picard's desk and they're trying to indicate that he's very busy. He's got a stack of them, like, spilling over on his desk. You know, and for a while watching that stuff, I rewatched a bunch of those recently and I was like, I couldn't understand why they were so being used so weirdly. And the answer is they don't have the internet. They have iPads and not the internet. So iPads are just space paper. They're not like our tablets are today. They only make sense as a portal into the network. You know, everything we do on them is about their use on the network. You would never have multiple pads for different documents, obviously, because those documents live on that digital device and are copied through the internet. And so as soon as you see that, like, they don't actually have, like, the iPads and tablets as we see them today, they are mostly the internet with a little bit of interface. And Star Trek doesn't have the internet, it just has the interface, which actually makes the futurism, like, totally wrong from my perspective.
Yeah, and it makes me realize that it was very kind of hub and spoke. You know, there was this central internet, but it was really just the core machine that was really smart, you know, the Gene Roddenberry's wife, you know, the voice of Majel Barrett kind of like in the background. She was like the HAL of Star Trek. And there was a hub and spoke where all the pads could basically talk to that. But that wasn't the cloud. And there was no peer to peer.
And it only works when it's live. You know, they're constantly talking about like they can't get subspace, you know, communication. It's basically CB radio. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they have these digital fabricators that can like produce beverages that can get aliens of different species drunk. But they can't, like, they don't seem to be able to make those, you know, digital, then they can make all those digital computers, but they don't seem to be able to, like, have the information technology to transmit, you know, data between them.
Which is really interesting when you juxtapose that with some of the things that are going on in Minority Report, because, like, let's say that, you know, Picard goes up to number one and says here and hands him the pad. In Minority Report, there's just a swipe gesture. It's just, I'm swiping it in your general direction and it jumps onto your table or it jumps into your eyes or it jumps onto your pad.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's one thing, one of my tiny little wars I fight as we work on the show is I try never to have anyone hand anyone else a flash drive or like a little hard drive. and that's like, that, it's a tiny little thing, but to me, it's something that matters because of what you just said. You know, it's the screenwriters often want it for narrative reasons. Like, how do you depict the story element of I am passing you a file. I'm giving you this critical information to our story. And, you know, and if you and I met and you asked me, oh, will you send me that file? I wouldn't whip out a flash drive and hand it to you. I'd say, okay. And then I would tap my phone and then you would have it. But that's totally invisible and not dramatic to watch. And that's one of the big challenges. And that's something like one of my ways of trying to address that challenge in Minority Report is to fight against handing flash drives and to have them just have a line or two of dialogue to send like, oh, I'll send you like a secure download link for that or whatever, you know, something like that. So that it's clear that they're actually just using the network and not passing those drives around.
It does seem like so many futurists and people who think about the future completely miss the idea of wireless and ubiquitous connectivity. I mean, in Snow Crash, they've got this amazing matrix that they jack into, but they do it from a payphone.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, which goes all the way back to William Gibson and the origins of cyberspace in the phone system, right?
Yeah, everyone seems to have there's a payphone. And right now, actually recently, one of my seven-year-old saw a payphone and was like, there's just a random phone sitting right here. It's so weird.
It is weird, yeah. And that's actually, you know, that's something, it's even stronger in television or film, which is that there's this visual bias, right? It's not a novel, it's a visual medium. And so that creates this incredibly strong bias towards any visual depiction of the future. So cool, weird looking hardware that, you know, cars or other things that look really different from today, or interfaces that are visual and splashy. Like the original Minority Report movie is extremely influential as a piece of science fiction, but it's also in like, I love it as a movie, don't get me wrong, but it's very shallow as a piece of science fiction. It basically depicts a world totally unchanged from the world of today, except with like really beautiful, fascinating gesture interfaces, you know? And like, it's most of those lessons in terms of the world that's depicted have already been fully digested 10 years, you know, 13 years later. And that's to me, you know, a little bit of a miss in terms of what I want from science fiction.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm sitting here and I'm talking to you with a 30-inch monitor that is probably 6 or 7 years old, works great. And I've got a 25 here and a 25 here. So I've got, you know, 5 or 6,000 pixels across. I am pretty much hooked up, but it's not really changed in the last 8 years. In Minority Report, when you go to the police station, they've got clear see-through LCDs. This seems to be the thing that says we're in the future, right? You show someone the reverse side of the LCD. But then when they go and visit one of their helpers, one of their like exiled police helpers, he doesn't have the fancy tech. He doesn't have the see-through LCD. What is that fascination with these transparent LCDs? And was that a conscious decision to indicate that he doesn't have as fancy stuff as they do back in the base?
Yeah, definitely. So that comes from one of our core principles of the futurism of the show, which is that, you know, there's the famous William Gibson quote that everyone knows, which is that the future is here. It's just not evenly distributed. And that really, we really try to do that, which is in a lot of science fiction visions, you get like, oh, and this is the future of X, you know, and then every single person has X technology, you know, no matter how rich they are, how poor they are, whether they're working in an institution, you know, like a police station or a fancy tech company, or whether they're just some individual on the street. And as anyone who's at all notices the role of technology in society knows, that's just not how technology works. You know, at any given time, there's some technology that's the new hot thing that everybody's super excited about. You know, right now we might name virtual reality or gesture interfaces or things like that. But then there's the ones that are ubiquitous, but still feel very new, like smartphones. Then there's the older ones that are even more ubiquitous, but are, you know, nobody even notices them as technology anymore, like laptops. And then you go back to, you know, I remember it wasn't that many years ago. I think it was in 2014. I remember reading the headline that India had just turned off their last telegraph system and still had 25,000 users, you know? So like the past doesn't just like that with a snap just disappear. It stays around. And so a realistic world of the future, there will still be people using things that look very much like smartphones. There might be, like in the future of 2065 in Minority Report, the newest piece of technology is the contact lens augmented reality computing, you know, and it's not like every person in the street suddenly has one of those. It's used for experts who need them in their job, like Detective Laura Vega, who's the lead character in the show. She's using it constantly in the course of doing her work because she's a specialist who needs it. And you'll see a few other people, but it's not ubiquitous. And then you'll see things like those variations you're talking about, like the police stations having the coolest, newest tech, you know, gesture interfaces. And then Wally, who's the tech they go to in the side, has the actual touch screen, you know, which isn't as slick and is not buying it with government's money. And, you know, it's a little, and it's probably a little bit older too.
You know, that's really, really valuable that you pointed that out, because I'm thinking about like the Microsoft just announced the price on the HoloLens developer kit, and it's going to be $3,000. And I think there's a minimum buy of two, right? So
right.
They immediately priced it all out completely. But they keep saying, hey, the HoloLens is not the Oculus Rift. This is a tool for high end, for, you know, for forensics, for architects and things like that. I think we all want whatever the new tech is to become ubiquitous and $300 overnight.
Yeah. And that, you know, some tech never becomes ubiquitous, you know, like the SR-71 Blackbird was pretty impressive in the 70s, but there's not one in every garage, you know, like that's just, and that's, you know, that's a kind of ridiculous example. But even then it's like, there's plenty of tech that like it only lives at institutions and specialized jobs and never waters down like that, you know, the Gartner hype cycle is not a rule of nature that happens for every technology.
Hey folks, I wanted to take a moment to tell you about Raygun and their new product called Pulse. Raygun is an error and crash reporting software provider, and their new product, Pulse, it's a real-time user monitoring product. It gives you performance data and user insights. Lets you understand exactly what's happening when users interact with your software, so you're never left guessing. Raygun provides you with the answers to your performance questions, and they've found over 10 billion, that's billion with a B, bugs in customer apps with their crash reporting product. And now Raygun will help you understand application quality like no one else. Over 30,000 developers worldwide can't be wrong. I use Raygun all the time, and I enjoy it very much. You can try it out today with a no-risk 30-day free trial. Start improving your software quality immediately. Try Raygun for free today at raygun.io. When you're thinking of these kind of technologies or trying to take a current technology and move it forward, it does make me wonder why things don't exist now. To use the example of two people meet, I've got a pad, you've got a phone, and I make a swiping gesture over to you. Right now, I mean, Bluetooth is a nightmare of pairing and lost connections and ridiculous, like, PIN numbers. We used to do the whole PIN number thing, and now half of my Bluetooth devices just have a PIN number of all zeros. You know, why is the idea of peer-to-peer pairing so ridiculous, and why am I not just moving my hand and swiping things over to you and having it jump the gap?
Yeah, so this is an area that John Underkoffler, he was the person who had my job on the original movie. Back in 2002. He was a graduate student at MIT at the Media Lab as well, in Hiroshi Ishii's Tangible Media Group. And he did the futurism for the movie. And that's what he does, is his company Oblong does exactly, that's the problem they work on solving, exactly what you're describing.
Oh,
they built the Fox News desk, if you've seen it, as like their set, and they have amazing demos where you go in a room and you walk in with your device and, you know, everybody, you can throw things from your tablet to the screen, and like, no matter what operating systems people are on, it all kind of works. And it's amazing. But, I think that that's an area where I actually have a very different view as a futurist, which is another one of my little things, I haven't succeeded in getting in the show yet, but I want to do a scene where they all come in with their different tablets and they actually spend 5 seconds pairing and getting stuck and not having that work. Like every room I've ever been in that used a projector. Because I think that's not a technical problem.
Oh,
that's a social and institutional problem, which doesn't get fixed, which is permanent. Because it's not a technical problem that gets solved. It's not silicon getting cheaper or faster. It's nothing like that. It's a nature of human institutions and like competition in business and standard settings and like the nature of human as social animals that means that those kind of problems never get solved, you know?
You have to do that. I work remotely for Microsoft, and I was on a meeting day before yesterday, and we spent, I swear to God, 12 or 13 minutes just, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Can you turn on? I mean, it was ridiculous. And these were smart people. And, you know, I thought that, oh, this is a problem with Skype, right? It must be wonderful on the other side. And someone else there used to work for Google. And he's like, no, we have the same problem with Hangouts. And someone else uses BlueJeans. It's like, there is literally no system that you can simply call someone and have the camera work and the mic work every single time reliably 100%. So I would love to see that not work in 50 years.
Yeah, this is part of my view about like when we cover Internet of Things-y things also, which is like the software, as anybody who works on software, works intimately with software knows, software is amazing, it's incredibly flexible, and it's broken at least 20% of the time. And so one of the things that, you know, if you're lucky, like a great system is broken only 20% of the time. And so one of the things that's going to happen as we put software in everything is it's going to have all this flexibility and programmability and changeability, and it will be broken 20% of the time. You know, systems that were used to being extremely robust and broken way less will be broken more. And, you know, that might mean we don't put software in the intimate parts of some like mission critical systems where that really, you know, life or death things where that really can't be. But it might also just mean that we'd make that trade-off. You know, we get used to, you know, like, you know, if you have a Tesla, you get in your Tesla, it's doing a software update and you can't drive for 10 minutes or, you know, a couple hours. And that's, you just get used to that because there's so many advantages. And like we mock that, and especially as programmers, we have a tendency to brutally criticize ourselves for our crappy quality and like how broken everything always is. But like, that's not a dystopian future. That's actually, you know, a trade-off that we're making for good reasons. You know, we should be conscious of those and critical of them. And we shouldn't believe, you know, certain kind of utopian pitches for technologies like the IoT that claim that that will never happen. We should always know that. We should be realistic about it. But that doesn't, you know, that's like, there's a worse is better thing that actually is better. It's a trade-off we want to make.
Yeah. I think it all depends though. And this is where it's hard to predict, right? I've got, Wi-Fi light bulbs, and I thought they were going to be a game changer. And I recently spent 2 solid hours trying to get the firmware updated on these light bulbs. And then I realized, okay, that's stupid. Wi-Fi light bulbs are a dumb idea, but I've got a Nest, which is a Wi-Fi enabled thermostat, and it's amazing. And I walk by and I wave my hand over it and it shows me the weather. And like, that's, you know, that works.
Mm-hmm.
I would not have guessed that I needed a Wi-Fi enabled thermostat, and I definitely wouldn't have guessed that the light bulbs would be a bust.
Yeah, one of the classic little metaphors for this that lives in my head is, like, whenever you go, I remember, like, when I started going into public bathrooms and there would be the proximity sensors on the faucets and on the paper towel dispensers. And I remember it for a long time, years, I was so angry every time I interacted with them because they work so badly. You know, they make you feel like you're, like, begging for a paper towel or for some water to come out of the tap. And I thought, like, why has this change happened? Like, this is some ridiculous adoption of fancy technology that is just making the experience worse. And then, you know, maybe it's obvious to other people, but then I realized that it's not about the user experience. It's about, sanitation. You know, it's about, like, not spreading germs by touching things. So it's like the, and that's actually why they've spread and become ubiquitous, because it's actually far better on just, like, an aspect of that experience I hadn't really thought through.
And so, like, in that case, it works 20% of the time.
Yeah. And so that idea that, like, the idea that there's this curve of permanent, you know, improving smoothness, transparency of user interface, and that's always the future is not, you know, I just, it's something I just simply don't believe.
Yeah, we definitely need to see a firmware where Vega's, you know, Vega's contact lenses get a firmware update. That would be brilliant. Let's dig in a little bit more about amazing technologies that were a promise, but maybe only work a little bit of the time. You are an author of a book called Making Things See from O'Reilly. You talk about Kinect and 3D vision and things like that. Kinect feels like one of those amazing technologies that sometimes just does weird stuff. I'll be standing in front of it. It totally sees my skeleton. And then suddenly my right leg is up on top of my head and it just shakes for a while. And then I'm freaking out. But it's still an interesting and valuable technology. But why is that so hard? Why is picking up motion capture and skeletal capture so complicated?
Well, I mean, as a technology, it's one of the things that's just kind of amazing that it works at all. You know, if you think about what
yeah,
it's doing,
I mean,
like
that's a
the 3D capture
it.
At a high frame rate and high resolution and the incredible, especially in the current Microsoft stack, just the incredible software stack that's going in, like the machine learning and incredible, you know, software achievements that are going into making the skeleton detection and all that stuff. But on the other hand, I think this is something I think about a lot, and it's, I think it's not just the reliability of it in some kind of objective sense. It's that the way it breaks is different than things that we're used to. You know, we're used to the way, you know, oh, spinny beach ball on the Mac, or like, oh, this web page, you know, the JavaScript is making the Chrome tab not responsive. Like, there's, like, we get used to the way technological systems fail. And so when we encounter new ones, and especially ones that work in, like, very different ways, like that, the Kinect is an example of computer vision and particularly machine learning systems, which tend to fail very differently than traditional interactive software systems, is that the way they fail is just alien. And so it's not that they're failing any worse. It's just that we don't have expectations around those. They're not, it's not legible to us how they're going to fail. And so a lot of the good design work in around those areas has to be about, like, explaining to the user. Like, one of the things in the early, when I started making Kinect projects, we just learned right away is you just have to show the user what you're seeing of them. Like, either the RGB color image, so they can tell, because you have users, like, it's not working, and, like, they're not standing on camera because they can't tell if the camera is seeing them. Or you show them the depth image and they don't realize, like, oh, they're leaning back against the seat. Or, you know, as soon, you have to show them some aspect of how the system is seeing them because it's totally illegible to them and they have no mental model because they've never interacted with anything that sees the world in the same way. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, depending on how ubiquitous those systems become or whether you get a body of users who use them a lot, like that, the literacy will improve and you'll stop having to do that as much. But especially in these early adoption periods or in technology that you don't use ubiquitous in your daily life. You have to teach users that.
Right. I've got a Surface, and as soon as I started using a touchscreen, I can't not have a touchscreen anywhere else. And I think when touch first came out, people thought that it was going to be a replacement for something. And really, it just augments things. You go keyboard, mouse, touch, and you move your hands around. I thought that when I saw Minority Report for the first time, that gesture-based, you know, simple gestures would be ready now by 2015. Like right now, I'm looking at a Skype window of you. I'd like to just point at it and go like that and just flick it off to the left and have it jump over to the monitors. It's almost unacceptable that that hasn't happened yet. And I've tried the Leap Motion. I've tried Kinect. I've tried there's a thing called a Mio, which connects to your forearm and things like that.
Yeah, it uses myoelectrical. Yeah. It uses myoelectrical impulses. Yeah.
None of those things are reliable enough. They all make amazing demos, but none of them have taken over the world.
Well, yeah, and there's other problems with them too. As somebody who's done a ton of Kinect projects, you know, there's a famous thing about the original Minority Report, which is that First of all, you know, a lot of the gesture interface vocabulary John Underkoffler and Hiroshi Ishii had come up with before the movie, but not all of it. Some of the gesture interface stuff you see in the movie, Tom Cruise actually invented. Like the gesture of using one hand down the length of the arm to do fast forward and rewind scrubbing. Like Tom Cruise came up with that on set because he's like, I need a precise gesture to do this. I can't. And he like, he was a precise enough actor that he had to think it through and he came up with it on set. But one of the other things that happened on the set of that movie is that he was standing for, you know, hours recording takes of the scenes where he's waving his hands around things, and his arms got so tired he couldn't hold them up anymore. And so in some of the scenes, he's actually wearing arm braces under his shirt that help hold his arms up. And like they had to limit the takes and stuff so that, you know, the fatigue could let him do the gestures. And to me, if I was a, you know, somebody who worked in interaction design on that set, I'd be like, wow, this is a red flag. Like, this is not something that people are going to do daily lives. Like, I don't know about you, but I'm not in as good shape as Tom Cruise. And like, I am not going to be able to hold my arm out in front of my, in front of myself for 5 or 8 hours a day while I'm working, you know? So I think you're right about the kind of hybrid, you know, multimodal thing of like, you move between and you flick and stuff like that. That's not the same thing as doing all of your work with your arm outstretched in front of you.
Right, exactly. This is what they call gorilla arms. This was what people, gorilla arms was what people would say that was going to cause gesture-based motions to just not happen. But I'm absolutely convinced that the future is multimodal, and I don't see it unreasonable at all for me to type, swipe, you know, just flick with my hands and then hand goes right back down to the keyboard. It feels like the tech could be there. Like there's no reason. Maybe it's just organizational willpower, or maybe I have to go and write it myself. Doesn't that seem like a good idea to just flick a window over to another monitor?
Yeah. I mean, there are those, some of those gesture systems are starting to come into places where they're really needed. Like, I've seen a bunch of the best gesture work I've seen is in sterile environments, like in surgery and stuff like that. You know, there's more and more telemedicine and like, just more technology in the operating room. And so I've seen some work and that's obviously an area where like you can't type on a keyboard or use a mouse while you're in a sterile environment. So there's a really strong reason to do gestures, and there's money, you know, you can put in more expensive systems and more kind of customized systems. And I think that's a big part of it too, is like the systems are going to train us as much as, you know, as much as you're waving your hand every time you mention that in the way you want to do it. You know, like one thing you learn when you do computer vision projects is like, if I can tell the user exactly how to do it, and then it will work a lot better. So constraints, you know, and that's just something that's more feasible in an expert system, or like we're in a system designed to be used by experts, because they can do some training on it, you know, and that's, you can't expect that, you know, for just a regular, you know, non-informed technology user for whom something's got to be legible and kind of work the first time.
Right. In any system that does recognition, a constrained vocabulary, whether that be specific words you can say or specific motions, so then you know what to look for, are going to make a huge difference. One of the other things that, shifting gears a little bit, that impressed me about the show was there are, kind of, if you watch, you can almost watch the show twice. You watch it for the actors, you watch it for the story, but then you go back and you just watch the background actions, just little subtle things that are happening. There was one scene when they're in a park and a couple walks by and their kids in a pram, in a little push cart. And it's an interracial couple, it's a gay couple, and the kid is inside the pram, but the pram has a translucent LCD iPad looking thing, and they're playing some boxes and lines game. So you've got the, you know, future of changing social mores, and you've got the transparent LCDs and gesture all.
And I think the pram condensed. Is driving itself also.
And the pram is driving itself all condensed into one thing. That has to have been completely planned out and scripted.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's almost the opposite of what I was saying about the difficulty of showing, you know, interface and the kind of the superficial aspects of technology, you know, in a televisual environment, is that, you know, it's hard to show the internet, but there's certain other kinds of changes that can be so dense and you can just show them so quickly. And a lot of those, like, the one of those I care the most about, honestly, is the demographic one. You know, that's a huge thing for us that we think about a lot. And, it comes from real demographic research in terms of, if you look at, like, what the age, race, you know, gender distributions of people in different jobs and in living in American cities will be in 2050. You know, when it comes to futurism, you almost never know anything for certain. But demographics is one of the few things we actually can say things with some confidence. Like, there's not going to be more 50-year-olds in 2065 than there are people born in 2015. You know, I don't say a lot of things with confidence, but I can say that one with a lot of confidence. You know, they're going to be fewer, but they're not going to be more. And that's an area we just know a lot about. Like, you know, the future is going to be more multiracial, and it's going to be more equitable in terms of sexual orientation and sexual identification. And, you know, it's going to be more equal for men and women in the workplace and all these things. And so that's just a way that we can very easily show it's the future, just in terms of casting. So, like, we cast all non-specifically mentioned parts, race blind and gender blind. And, you know, and we do, and we really emphasize, we push constantly with our production teams for the background actors to get, you know, really diverse background actors. Cause I think it's a really subtle visual clue that lets you know you're in the future. Mm-hmm. The visual storytelling in all of those moments, and taking small details and letting them tell you something bigger about the world is something mm-hmm. that we try really hard to do. One of my favorite ones like that is in the first episode, which is that the episode features a candidate for the mayor of DC. And at one point he mentions that he was a professional football player and he played for the Washington football team, which is the Washington Red Clouds. Mm-hmm. And that came out of, you know, obviously today the Washington football team is named the Redskins, which is a name with a racist history, that there's a lot of resistance and pressure to change it. And so I looked up what people who advocate for changing it, what would they want to change it to? And they want to name it after Red Cloud, who's a native leader. And, you know, that I believe that was something that will change in that time. And actually, this is an area also, it gets into kind of a wider sense of how we try to think about the future, which is, a lot of science fiction, you want to be critical of the present. It's like one of the things you want to do. You want to like look at what's wrong about the present and talk about what's wrong with it and identify those problems. And in the last 30 years, especially, the main mode for doing that has been dystopia. It's been a way of taking the negative things that are bad today and pushing them out further and imagining kind of a reducto ad absurdity of them. And I think that's, you know, some of that's been very powerful. Like, and one that comes to mind for me is Children of Men, which shows a kind of security state dystopia that's just very visceral and powerful.
Yeah. And such an amazing movie for anyone who's listening. Like, please, Children of Men, like, you might as well just pause the podcast now and go and rent Children of Men.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, but I also think that as, you know, and I'm a huge fan in sci-fi literature of cyberpunk, you know, from William Gibson and Bruce Sterling and Neal Stephenson and in the early 80s, you know, going forward. But I think that to some extent that has become such a ubiquitous tone and mode in science fiction that it doesn't have the impact it used to have. Like, it doesn't feel critical anymore. It just feels depressing. People mm-hmm. bounce off of it. So then the question was, we wanted to tell this, like, present this complex world. It's not Star Trek. It's not just utopia. But it's optimistic. It's as optimistic as I feel about the present. But we still want to be able to be critical. So that's a kind of conundrum that we faced. And I think things like that Red Clouds example and the diversity are an example that something that we've really fixed on as a strategy for that I'm really excited about. And I want to see other science fiction properties do, which is, the way you criticize the present is you show it being exceeded. You show the future being better. You see these problems that we're stuck, that we can't get past today, that we're constantly, you know, like, you see them just improved. You see, like, oh, there's just, you know, multiracial couples and, you know, gender diversity and fewer people have a problem with it. And, you know, it's not being Pollyanna about that in the present. It's modeling a world that can have that and can get past the kind of difficult problems, that there is a route to that. And where possible, showing what that route is by being specific and precise about the way you do that.
Very cool. Very cool. Well, I really, really appreciate having you on the show today. And I encourage folks to watch Minority Report. It's really, really a great show, and I'm enjoying it very much.
Thanks a lot, Scott. Thanks for having me. It's been great to be here.
Absolutely. This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.